will come to order, and the clerk will note the roll, and we have a quorum. Somewhere around the, running around the room is our quorum, but I know they're ready to vote, so who's here? Okay. Representative Anderson moves the minutes of March 8th. Is there any discussion on the minutes of March 8th? If not, all those in favor of minutes of March 8th, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. The motion prevails and the minutes for March 8th are approved. First item, we got an announcement. The Aviation Subcommittee will meet March 14th at 10 a.m. in room 300 South, of those of you that are interested in that. First blow up is Representative Severson's House File 1134.
What room?
300
South.
March 14th. In the packets, the bill is in the very back if you're trying to find it. We were trying not to do this bill today, but Representative Severson prevailed on us, so we moved it from the back of the pack to the front of the pack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I've told that individual not to slash his tires. We pulled him back. He's not going to do it now. And Mr. Chair, I would move House File 1134 for approval and for passage and pass on to the general calendar.
General Register. Thank you.
And I do have one amendment, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, this is amendment.
And I would please, as the member, would like to do a delete all and incorporate H1134DE1 amendment.
Representative Stevenson moves his amendment. All in favor of the amendment, which is a delete all, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same sign. The amendment is adopted, and we now have the bill as the author would like in front of us. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is bringing us into the 21st century. When you go to the auto dealers and you purchase a car, oftentimes what happens is you have to sign the papers, and then you get a little pink slip that basically stick in the back of your auto until your plates and your sticker arrive, typically 2 to 3, maybe even longer later. This makes provision for an auto dealer to actually be assigned the license plates and the tags and allow the individual to put them on a car at that point and to kind of work in terms of the 21st century in terms of electronic information, where the dealer would actually put the information in and it would go on. And I go on this, I'm going to get in trouble, so I'm going to pass it over to Alyssa Schlander, who is from the Auto Dealers Association, and she will explain the rest of the bill.
Welcome with me. Please identify yourself and take.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Alyssa Schlander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. We represent all of the franchise new car dealers in Minnesota. As Representative Severson just told you, this bill represents a big step towards solving the chronic problem of slow and backlogged title processing. The delete everything amendment represents many hours and many drafts with all the interested parties, and so there is no more opposition to this bill. We're all in agreement. But I'll just tell you the little background on the need for this bill. The current system that we have for processing motor vehicle titles in Minnesota is outdated and just simply cannot keep up with the demand that there is. The current system requires there to be multiple points of manual data entry of the exact same information, and that's really what slows down the system. And, slow title processing has been a top concern of dealers and customers for the last several years. At one point this past summer and fall, the state was backlogged in processing titles by, depending on who you talk to, anywhere from 2 to 5 months. And so that means if a customer comes to buy a car, they're not going to get their title back processed to them for, you know, for several months. And that reflects poorly on the dealerships, and so we're concerned. You know, the state is caught up now, but that's partially due to the fact that sales have been slow, which is typical in the winter months. But, you know, the spring sales season is right around the corner, and it's very likely that the state will once again find themselves back in the same soup again with a backlog that they can't handle. And so that's why we're proposing a way to alleviate the demand. What we need is 21st century technology, as Representative Steverson mentioned. We just need to make the system easier and more efficient. And, you know, with that said, we realize that there are budget constraints that we cannot really afford to have. The state can't afford to buy us the system that we need. So what the auto dealers are proposing is a way to create the system that would offer customers convenience and efficiency as an option. Dealers are able to and are willing to contract with a third-party vendor to be able to create software that will be specially created to transfer this data from the dealership's computers to the state's computers, so that the dealers and deputy registrars and the state, instead of all operating on, you know, several different tracking systems, we'll all be operating off the same system and using the same data. The auto dealers have been consulting with a company called CVR, Computerized Vehicle Registration. This is a company that currently operates in about 20 other states to do this type of data transmission between dealerships and Department of Motor Vehicles, Driving Vehicle Services offices in other states. Wisconsin is one of the states that uses this type of system, and Wisconsin has really had a lot of success in improving their service delivery. As I said before, the dealer is already entering in the customer's data and the vehicle data into their computers. They also have to fill out paperwork that, you know, is required by both state and federal law. We've got many disclosure and signature requirements that won't go away under our new system. They then give that paperwork to the deputy registrar. The deputy registrar collects it. They enter in the same data that the dealer already entered into their system to track and do their reporting to the state. And then the deputy registrar hands off the paperwork again to the state, and the state gets this backlog, and they have to enter more data and audit more paperwork. Well, what we're proposing is, at the point where the dealer is entering in the data on the customer and the vehicle, this third-party vendor will create software that will suck it out of the dealer's computer, for lack of a better word, and give it to the state in whatever format, whatever system the state is using. This will not cost the state anything. The third-party vendor can and will, as they have in other states, create a customized system for the state of Minnesota, so that when the paperwork then flows to the deputy registrar, the deputy registrar will do the audit at that point. So essentially what we're doing is we're taking work away from the state and putting it onto the deputy registrar, so that we're cutting down on manual entry of data and allowing the deputy to do the audit function that the state now does. And, you know, in essence, we can get these titles turned around in a matter of 2 weeks rather than the 2 to 5 months that we are sometimes facing when demand is high. As I said before, we're proposing this language that will allow dealers to offer this service as an option to customers who are interested in the convenience of having their titles processed quickly, as I was just describing, but also the ability to get their license plate attached to their car at the dealership. Right now, as Representative Steverson was saying, you buy your car, you get a little tag that gets taped on your back window, and it's going to take you, you know, several weeks to get your license plate back. Either you're going to have to come back to the dealership, or you're going to have to wait for it to come in the mail. This service would allow us to be able to provide the option to customers to give them their license plate right at the spot, so it's an added convenience for customers. So the service would be that. You get your license plate on the spot, you get your title processed more quickly, and this is going to be a huge convenience for many customers. But the beauty of this proposal is customers who don't find value in this will not have to buy it. The bill is mainly enabling language to make the new system function. Section 1 of the Delete Everything just gives the commissioner the authority to allow dealerships to handle license plates and registration. And it will also require training for the dealers so that, you know, they're using the technology properly. And this is frankly something that we've already started to do in conjunction with Driver and Vehicle Services, training certified title clerks so that our employees that are handling motor vehicle documents are experts at handling all the intricacies and requirements that go along with that. I'm going to skip Section 2 of the Delete Everything just for a minute, but I'll come back to it. Section 3 of the Delete Everything spells out that the deputy registrars using this system will also need to be trained to use the technology, and that they will be responsible now for the auditing function that the state does currently. And the fee that the deputy registrars are currently collecting, they will continue to collect because they are still being asked to perform the same functions with respect to the paperwork that they are now. The paperwork that happens now will all stay in place. What we're just, again, doing is creating a system where we can cut down on data entry into a computer system. Section 4 of the Delete Everything it deals with the fee that the dealer will charge the customer for this premium service. It basically does three things. It allows that the fee that the dealers charge for the service can be financed as part of the customer's car payment. And that's important because the financing documents are pretty highly regulated, and we just wanted to make sure we had our bases covered, that it was okay to finance this particular service charge. Secondly, it requires that this charge be separately stated as an optional electronic transfer fee so that it's clear to customers that this is an optional service. And I think that's fair. And then finally, it puts a floating cap on how much the dealers can charge for this, so that whatever the dealer is charging the customer, half will go to the service provider and half will go to the dealership. And just so we're clear, the dealer is not getting 100% markup on this. Out of the dealer's half of the fee, they will still have to pay for training their employees, for software upgrades, for tech support, and for the security measures that are required in Section 1 of the bill. So, you know, the dealers will profit a little bit on this, but, you know, in essence, what we really want to do is create the system and get the system built. I'll just go back to Section 2 just briefly because I skipped that before. Section 2 of the bill repeals language that would have allowed dealers to keep $2.50 of the fee that the deputy registrar gets for processing titles. We added that language a few years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, when the deputy registrars had a bill that was open. And it was at that time that we envisioned a system of e-transfers that would have meant less work for the deputy registrars and more work for the dealers. We at that time thought we could have this system where the dealers would essentially be doing part of the deputy registrar's duties. And as we've, you know, struggled and tried to come up with a way to build this system, we've realized that can't be the case. And we just, there are proprietary interests that won't allow us to do that. So it's not fair for us to keep the ability to collect this $2.50 of their $7 fee. But just so you know, we've never collected that because there's been no system to allow us to do that. So it's just sort of I don't know if you could call it a technicality, but it's really just a fairness issue. So anyway, that's the bill, which sounds a little more complicated than it actually is. Let me just conclude by saying that this bill is a good bill. It really represents a modernization of the system for processing motor vehicle titles, something that touches just about everyone in the state. And it's really a win-win for everybody involved. You know, customers will benefit because they'll have the option of having a more convenient and efficient system available to them, get their titles more quickly, and their license plates right on the spot. Dealers benefit because we get satisfied customers and a more efficient and convenient system to work with. Deputy registrars benefit because they stay involved in the process, and they're getting documents from us with fewer errors on them. And the state benefits by a reduction in their title backlog and basically an expanded service capacity at no additional cost to the state. So with that, I'll conclude, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any choice if I come in to buy a car and you're going to do all this for me and you're going to charge me how much and let me know how the process works and who gets the fees and so forth? Would you just run through a single transaction?
Sure. We don't exactly know how much this is going to cost, but in the 20 or so odd states that the company that we've been consulting with currently operates, Wisconsin included, the fee is about $20, and it will vary. We don't exactly know what our costs will be. In Wisconsin, it's $19.50 to have this service.
So once you inform me it's $20, you're going to transmit that information directly to the department, or what does the deputy register have to do with this?
What will happen is when the dealer enters in the data into their computer system, this information then is transmitted to the state's computer system via this third-party vendor who creates the software and handles the secure data transmission. The deputy registrar then receives the paperwork, the title work, the applications, the fees, check money.
Which one?
What do you mean?
Which deputy register?
There are, I think, 170 or
well,
so.
Well, what I mean is it the one that's located nearest the auto dealer or someone?
Yeah, it's my understanding, Mr. Chair, that the deputy registrars have market areas, and
okay.
So I would assume typically that deputy registrar that's closest to the auto dealer.
Well, I was just curious. I mean, if I were to snooze you as a dealer, because I'm a deputy register, I'm going to get part of the fee, as I understand it. I'm not going to, as a deputy register, you're going to get any of the fee?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry if I was unclear about that. The deputy registrar currently gets $7 for every transaction that they handle, and they will continue to collect their $7 fee.
But only if you use that deputy register. How do you select the deputy register that you're going to use what's the name of the Ford dealership over here? Any dealership. How do you select the deputy register?
I'm getting vague.
Okay.
The deputy registrar is...
I'm just trying to follow the money here in the process.
Relationships that they typically handle transactions.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Gary Spooner. I'm president of the Minnesota Deputy Registrar Association and deputy registrar in Cottage Grove. The dealers can actually choose any deputy registrar that they want to do business with. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the area that they are doing business. They can make a decision on whomever they want to.
Well, I can understand that, but my concern is that some deputy registrar who is a good marketing specialist could tie up all of the... I'm just being concerned for you that... You can tie up all of the dealerships in the metro area, for instance, and the rest of the deputy registers are only going to be applicable to what happens in Aiken, Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, I think that the way that the system presently works is that relationships are developed between deputy registrar offices and automobile dealerships that I think will still be strong in that area.
Okay.
Surely there's marketing that takes place, but I don't think that you're going to find one deputy that's going to be out there in front with all of the dealers going through them. I think that would be...
Well, that's an exaggeration, of course.
Yeah, I think that would probably be too much for... I'd love it myself, because I
probably... Well, I thought some enterprising deputy registrar out there might be thinking about that.
Well, there could be, but usually it'd probably take them too big of a staff in order to meet that demand.
Okay, now the fee that I just paid you as a purchaser of an automobile from Mr. Schlander, and that's, you're not going to retain any of that as a dealer.
No, the fee that we're talking about charging for this premium service, getting your plate and your title process, will be split between the software service provider, electronic transmission service provider, and the dealership.
Okay. Wasn't there a Cox? Do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a couple questions. First, related to the electronic transmission service provider, can you tell me a little bit about, you know, who are they? How many of them are around? Are they typically in state, or is this somebody that's working in India or something? Or I mean,
yeah, they could be.
Well, they could be. Yeah, that's it. I don't know. I'm not familiar. And then if we even had a definition of them, I don't know that we do. But who are they?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cox, it's a good question. The company that we have been primarily consulting with to help us create the system and the idea of creating the system, called CVR, they're based out of California, and they operate in about 20 other states. I would say maybe 99% of dealerships use one or the other of two large financial computing systems, either ADP or Reynolds and Reynolds. Those two, ADP and Reynolds, are just fierce competitors. But for the purpose of transmitting this kind of data to state driver and vehicle services offices, ADP and Reynolds have formed a joint venture to market this service, if you will, to dealers and state driver and vehicle services offices, so that they are able to access the data that's in those ADP and Reynolds systems that are used by dealerships and transmit the data in that way. There are other electronic service providers out there in the market, and I'm sorry, I just don't know how many there are. We've just been, you know, because this makes sense for our dealers, for the new car dealers, this is who I'm most familiar with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then one last question. When you were talking about the fees, you used the word cap, and I'm thinking that maybe is not the proper word on there, because I don't see a cap on the fees in here. What I see is a split. The level of the fee for this service is not set in this bill, and there's no cap on it, is there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cox, I mean, there's not a cap in so much as it says this fee will be X amount, but because it says half the fee must be paid to the electronic service provider, that means we can only charge, mm-hmm. you know, half again as much to the customer. So in that sense, it's a floating cap, so we don't have to come back here every 15 years and say, well, mm-hmm. inflation.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Schlander, as it relates to Representative Cox's question on the split, I imagine market forces would keep the, keep the fee low in terms of the service providers competing with each other to keep that fee low. But that's an issue that does kind of pop out at me is, you know, the possibility that sometime in the future, if those market forces aren't in place, that in fact, if the third party could be charging a fee that's perhaps beyond what the cost of the service is, and that'd be one concern that I'd have as you move forward. Is I think we, you know, hope to have some relationship between the cost and the service, or the service and the cost of that service. And if it's $20, it sounds pretty reasonable, especially since it's optional. But that's just something that that I think we ought to think about moving to the future, because I'd hate to see over time that fee become a profit center for anybody, if in fact it's not costing that to provide the service.
Yeah,
Mr. Chair, Ms. Larson,
Schlander.
I don't know that you really had a question, but I think what you're saying is correct, that this is an optional fee, and the fee, I mean, it just can't get out of control because then people won't buy it. It just won't be worth purchasing. And, you know, I mean, we intend that this will continue to be an optional product for for people to choose. Does that help?
Well, I think so.
Mr. Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think so, except that, you know, I know when, you know, you're buying a car, sometimes, you know, you're looking through things, and some of the last details, if you're so excited to drive that thing off the lot, you know, you want your license plates now, absolutely, you know, let's go. You know? And, you know, this isn't a huge concern. I just think it's something that maybe we ought to keep our eye on, because if it's at $20 or something close to that, again, that seems like a reasonable thing, but I'm not sure that everybody is line-iteming, questioning the fees that they're being charged. I think they're, you know, to the point where they've made the purchase decision, and they're, you know, you could significantly increase that, and it wouldn't have a great impact on the amount that, you know, in proportion to the amount they're spending on that purchase. So, you know, we all know how our perception can change, and so, you know, I don't have anything to offer that would provide that protection. I just think that that's an issue that I want to raise for us to think about for the future, and perhaps keep our eye on as we experience this play out, presuming this is passed.
Mr. Lander, would it be less costly if I choose not to accept the rapid response of your service? Could I do it in the old-fashioned way, or are you going to eliminate that?
No, absolutely. You can still do it in the old-fashioned way. This is just just an option for customers to consider.
Representative Mayor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the benefit of someone who isn't all that computer literate.
Please, right down.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the benefit of someone like me who isn't all that great with a computer, why do we need this third-party vendor, the electronic transmission service provider, and would it be possible that the state of Minnesota would be able to, in effect, step into that role if they've got the correct software, and then the state of Minnesota gets the $10?
Ms. Schlander?
Mr. Chair and Representative Newman, you know, when I was talking about Section 2 of the bill, and that's how we sort of envisioned the system to unfold a few years ago, the problem with that is that when the dealer is entering in the data on the customer and the vehicle at step one of the process, they're entering that data into closed financial computer networks. And once it's in those computer networks, those companies view that as their proprietary information. And they're not going to let that information just be shared with anybody who wants it, including the state. So, you know, we thought maybe it could be that easy to just say, you know, it's already in there. Can't we just have it and give it to the state? I mean, it's all the information the state needs. And that has just turned out not to be the case. That they aren't willing to share. So that is part of the reason why we need to contract with a third party vendor who will be able to access that information and essentially, you know, charge us for accessing the information. And the other reason that, you know, the state just can't afford to create the system. I mean, I wish they could, but this is not a big high priority. Except for us. So.
Representative Cox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to pick up. It sounded like Representative Larson and I were thinking of the same thing, and I'm just a little concerned that those of us that are old enough remember when a closing statement on a house, when you bought a house 30 or 40 years ago, looked way different than it does today as far as fees and so forth, and that I just hope this isn't promoted and buried in, and it is just simply a profit center, that it is something that is truly presented as an option to the customer that's buying a car if they want to get the plates right now, but that that it doesn't get presented as that this is what you have to do, and that it becomes the job of the consumer to investigate and say, well, no, I really don't want to, and you have to say that 10 times until it's finally eliminated from the form or something. And the second part of this, and this is just an education deal, is that by including it in the financing option, you know, if it's only $20 or $25, then they should know what that turns into over a 60-month financing or something. But those are just two concerns I have.
Sure, and just briefly, Mr. Chair and Representative Cox, and you know, you're not the first person to raise that concern, and because of that, I'll just direct your attention to page 3, line 35, where it says that the charge must be separately stated mm-hmm. and identified as an optional electronic transfer fee mm-hmm. On the sales agreement that's required to be given to the consumer, so it will be clear that it is an option.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was my first concern when I looked at signing on to this bill, and I decided to sign on to this bill because my industry, like the auto dealers industry, relies upon the Department of Vehicle Services to transfer titles on a timely basis. And it's very important for both the businesses involved and the consumers in these transactions that the titles get transferred on a timely basis. And what this bill is doing and why I'm a co-sponsor of it is it puts some efficiency in the system. Now, it doesn't directly benefit the automotive recyclers in Minnesota who also rely on the Department of Vehicle Services, but by taking off some of the burden, it will make it easier for other industries that rely on this government service to be prompt and efficient. And so I just wanted to say, as a co-sponsor of the bill who supports the bill, that was my first concern, that this wasn't another way for auto dealers to make money from consumers. And as somebody who has a lot of experience trying to process titles through DVS, we respect and appreciate all the hard work that they do, but it is a part of our government bureaucracy that could work faster, and I think this is a good effort taken by private industry to help that happen.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, and either Ms. Schlender or maybe Ms. McCormick, but do we have any concerns on any data privacy when we're using a third-party vendor on this?
Maybe Ms. McCormick could better answer that.
Ms. McCormick, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Pat McCormick with Driver and Vehicle Services. We have been meeting with CVR to discuss a contractual agreement that would allow for this service to be available, and those concerns will be addressed in that contract agreement. The department's legal counsel is working with the legal counsels from CVR. We have had several meetings. We've talked about those concerns. We have talked with people from other states. I've talked to some people in Wisconsin that feel that it works very well. There has not been problems in regard to that, and so we are confident that we can enforce the data privacy in this situation. So we feel comfortable with it at this time.
Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments for the author or for Ms. Schlender? Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Okay, I guess we're ready for Representative Severson to renew his motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and this is the short line with the DMV. This is some efficiencies. I think that it's been encouraging to see that we're working on efficiencies through the private sector. I would envision that hopefully in years to come, as this kind of gets some traction, that maybe we can use it as a revenue source. I can't believe I'm saying that. But I think it's got potential for actually creating the efficiencies in the system that shortens the time for getting the titles through and gets the plates to the individual quicker. And hopefully it will grab on. And I think the important part of this bill is that it is currently optional, that it's not a mandatory, and that people have the option to have the service or not to have the service. So I encourage I'm encouraged by the debate. I appreciate it, and I would move for the bill to pass as amended and be moved to the General Register.
All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same time. Motion prevails, and House File 1134 is on its way to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Next bill is House File 1354, Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would like to move House File 1354, be recommended to pass to and sent to Transportation Finance.
Okay, great.
We do have an amendment, Mr. Chair, and I think it would be prudent to do that first because that really is the gist of the bill. And it's the A050184. I would like to move that.
All in favor of Amendment A050184, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill is now amended and in the proper form. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you can see, this bill increases some of the deputy registrar's filing fees by $1.50 and then continues on. Just wanted to let you know that these are in the governor's budget, the $1.50 in each of the areas. In looking at the amendment, what it does do is it reduces the increased fees by $1 and removes the language related to the Financial Crimes Task Force. So any of that Financial Crimes Task Force language will be removed. And that is because we do have a separate bill, House File 1568, that is going through that will address those issues. This bill will increase the filing fee that is retained by the deputy registrars on longer procedures by $1.50, which does go from $7 to $8.50 until June 30th of 2007. And then a $5 increase, which is a total of $12, and your bill says $13, but the amendment changes that to $12 for transactions after that date. The bill also provides that a deputy registrar fee will no longer be built into the driver's license fee, but will instead be a separate surcharge of $5 until June 30th of 2007, and then $10 after that. If you look on page 3 of your bill, you'll see, for example, this is driver's license, $18.50, and that is removed, and is $15. It just removed the $3.50, and so it is, in essence, putting on a surcharge of $5, which is really an increase of $1.50. I have two witnesses with me, and I'm going to let them testify at this point, and so I'll turn it over to Gary Spooner.
Thank you. Again, I'm Gary Spooner, President of the Minnesota Deputy Registrar Association and Deputy Registrar in Cottage Grove. We're looking for this to pass. Actually, the dollar and a half that the administration has offered is pretty remarkable because that hasn't happened to us in the 30 years that I've had my office, that the administration comes up with an increase in fees. We're entering into a new era with driver and vehicle services. The offices now are online. We're able to enter information immediately onto the state mainframe. We're able to do the work that was done by the department in many ways. Actually, I think that the 170 offices throughout the state is now the labor force that is going to be able to efficiently provide the state and the customer with the service that they need and they want. And in order to do this, of course, we are looking for an increase in fees to cover our costs. As we always used to say, that it usually takes us a year to 2 years to train somebody in our business because there are so many different avenues and changes and everything that comes down the line. There's in the years that I've been there. If I could remember what I did 30 years ago, it isn't what I did yesterday in this business. It is becoming exciting to us, and we'd like to be a part of it as far as the deputy registrar system is concerned. We are looking forward to providing the enhancements so that this can take place. And we're with 170 offices now being able to go online, and they provided their own equipment to do this, and their own training. And of course, we have to be trained also. We have to have certified clerks in order for us to enter everything that the department wants us to enter. So we're looking at an increased workload, and we're also looking for an increased speed. I'm ready for any questions that you may have. If you want.
My name is Grace Lafferwitz, and I'm the Deputy Registrar of White Bear Lake, and I am also the Vice President of our association. And I want to thank particularly the Department of Vehicle Services for supporting the $1.50 increase of this year. They, too, have realized that we are a vital part to the process of registering vehicles here in the state of Minnesota, and they recognize that we did need that increase. We are also proposing an increase in 2 years. As Gary Spooner has described, our role with the state and with our consumers is changing. Our costs have changed. We need to be more electronically fine-tuned, more equipment, more capital investments. It is more time-consuming now because more and more of our duties are going to be with our long, more difficult transactions. As you know, the short forms, the tag renewals are done on the internet. They're quick, they're fast. We don't get those anymore. We are getting more of the long, detailed transactions, which is more labor intensive. And so that is just a few reasons why we need that fee increase, particularly in 2007. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
I'm just going to suggest, sir, are you going to... What? Who started talking? I don't know who that was. Oh. I was going to suggest to the Representative Holberg, when this goes to the committee, we ought to have some numbers on how much we're spending on the trunk highway fund. And I think we are shifting the direction in which this money is going to be.
Well, Mr. Chair, I assure you we'll take every effort to guard the trunk highway fund in my committee.
I didn't hear what you said, but I assume that it was a good answer. Okay. Representative Seibert.
It's Gazelka, but that's okay.
Oh. What?
No way. By the end of the session, somebody stole my pen.
Yeah.
It wasn't me, Mr. Chair. I just want you to know that. I deeply respect you.
But it's so funny.
I've got a question. The amendment that took out the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force, my assumption that there's another bill coming with that, will those fees also be added to the fees that we're talking about increasing here?
What we have done with that, if you notice that the fees on line 14 were $9.50, that was now reduced to $8.50, and the fees of $13 was reduced to $12. So we're not taking that $1 into consideration,
Mr. Chair. But will that be additional money that eventually is added to the total fee? Is that something you see coming?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I see that. You think it's going to be part of it? Oh, if the legislature chooses to, to add it to it, it's in the Senate file, then it's going to be a part of it.
Okay. One last question, Mr. Chair. How will that compare us to other states with similar fees for this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kozalka, I think that other states near us, as I can see, that that were comparable as far as what the increase would be comparable with what Wisconsin, Iowa, Nebraska are having presently. There are some states that are quite a bit more. There are no states that I can that I came across that were less.
Okay. Representative Holder.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to let Representative Fasolka know that there are a number of provisions or bills that will increase fees in a number of areas that will come to Transportation Finance, and the Transportation Finance Committee will put together an omnibus bill and bring that to the House floor, and then everybody will have a chance to load it up, down, amend it, whatever. And so they're being heard here. We'll be referred to the committee, and there won't be a committee bill come out probably till the second week of April.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Woods.
And Mr. Chair, and just along with what Representative Holberg said, it is consistent in that we do oftentimes have the same information in more than one bill so that it's traveling different ways to make sure that it does get taken care of. But since it is in the Senate bill, we decided to remove it and just have this be a cleaner bill. That's why it's not in this bill. Not that we don't think they deserve it. I'm sure they do, and they do. They have a great task that they do, but we chose not to have it in this bill.
Are there any questions or comments? If not, Representative Ruth, would you like to renew your motion?
I renew my motion that House File 1354 be recommended to pass and be sent to Transportation Finance.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you.
All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
The bill is passed and goes to Transportation Finance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Ruth.
That was me.
House File 1461.
I was making mine pretty. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Are you ready? Ready to go?
Please.
Mr. Chair, I move House File 1461 be recommended to pass and proceed to civil law. That's where it needs to go. And we do have an amendment, and I'll pass that right now. It's a technical amendment with just some terms. It's H 1451A1, and I would move that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ruth moves H 1461A1. All those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you see on the amendment, it's on page 8 of your bill, and it just changes in immediate term certificate to be long-term, and we're deleting long-term in line 20 to insert six-year certificate, so it's just in title. This bill makes various technical corrections to motor vehicle law, primarily with respect to disability parking. The bill specifically provides language to distinguish between temporary, short-term, long-term, and six-year certificates. several organizations rent out adopted vehicles, but they have a difficult time trying to manage handing certificates. Some people take them, some people throw them away. So when we're renting a handicapped vehicle, when the handicapped vehicle was coming back, unfortunately the permits weren't returning for some unknown reason. And it also, this bill also allows a person to be issued up to two disabled certificates if the person does not have disability plates. Currently, a person is allowed to have one set of plates and one certificate. The six-year certificate means a certificate valid for 6 years, and that's known by the disabled community as a permanent certificate. The bill also specifies that the driver of a vehicle with a certificate has parking privileges only while the vehicle is parked while transporting a physically disabled person. The bill allows cancellation of certificate for improper use, fraud in obtaining, error in issuance, death of certificate holder, removal of certificate holder from Minnesota, and failure to comply with law. This bill provides new requirements for organization certificates. The organizations must have internal controls to prevent misuse. It's currently against the law to obstruct access to a disabled parking space. This bill is expanding the definition for the parking space to include the associated access aisle. That's the diagonal lines that you see by the handicapped parking space. There are people that are trying to park in there. So this would make it, as you will see in the bill, it is also a misdemeanor at $500. But if that is the only change in it, as related to dollars, it expands that. There are no fees. There are no additional fees in this bill. It does not change any new fee for disability plates. And also the Disability Council maintains that no one, will see a fee increase as a result of this bill. I do have two testifiers, and so at this point, if it's all right, I will introduce Margaret Indicross, please.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself as a seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Margot Indicross, and I'm an accessibility specialist with the Minnesota State Council on Disability. On behalf of the Minnesota State Council on Disability, I urge your support of House File 1461, the Disability Parking Bill. I would like to take this opportunity to highlight some of the language changes that most impact the disability community. This legislation clarifies the types of certificates available to individuals with disabilities and their costs, if any. It allows an individual with a disability to obtain multiple sets of disability license plates if they own a vehicle that has been modified for their disability. Up until now, an individual with a disability could only obtain one set of disability license plates, regardless of how many disability-modified vehicles he or she owned. This should reduce the number of disability parking certificates that are lost or stolen because more people will be able to take advantage of purchasing disability plates. This bill makes perfectly clear that the operator of a motor vehicle only has disability parking privileges while transporting an individual with a disability. There is confusion in the community, and many people think that as long as they are doing an errand on behalf of somebody with a disability, they can use disability parking. And we want to make it clear that that's not the case. House File 1461 also authorizes the Minnesota State Council on Disability to report suspected disability parking violators to the Department of Public Safety. It clarifies the authority of the commissioner or the Department of Public Safety to revoke disability parking certificates and permits for improper use or require a new medical statement. And as medical technology advances, I think that's increasingly important. It used to be that if you had a bad knee, you had a bad knee forever. If you had a bad hip, you had a bad hip forever. Well, now you just simply get it replaced. And there are people out there who have long-term disability parking certificates who go out on their lunch hour and jog. And so we want to make sure that if those types of individuals are using disability parking certificates, and they're jogging 2 to 3 miles a day, then maybe they need to submit a new medical statement because there may be somebody who needs that certificate a little bit more than they do. It clarifies that a person may not alter a certificate. I'm not sure if you've noticed, but there are a lot of altered certificates out there. and it makes it real clear that that's not permitted. It clarifies that the access aisle is part of the disability parking space. About a decade ago, we changed the building code to require the design of the disability parking space to change, and it required the hatch marked areas. And there's a 5-foot hatch marked area for standard cars with disability identification, and then there's an 8-foot hatch marked area for van accessible disability parking spaces. And we found that some people actually try to park their vehicle in that 8-foot hatch marked area, which then if I'm the van user, I can no longer get in my van, or if I'm a van user, I can no longer get out of my van. So it really is, and it shouldn't be permitted, but we just want it clarified because law enforcement has expressed concern that it's kind of vague. So we make it perfectly clear that the access aisle is part of the disability parking space. The demand for disability parking increases every year. The demand is fueled by many factors. Those with temporary disabilities, newly disabled individuals gaining independence by learning to operate a motor vehicle, and older individuals with age-related disabilities increasing their independence by utilizing disability parking. Unfortunately, as well, abuse of disability parking is also a serious problem. The proposed changes will clarify and protect this important law while giving the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety additional tools to identify and deal with those who abuse the law. We urge your support of these changes. Thank you.
Representative Hulbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And two questions. Number one, do you know how many violations of fraudulent use of the certificates there are in an average year? And number two, allowing two certificates, doesn't it increase the risk of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hulbert. May I answer the second question first?
Okay.
The two certificates, that has pretty much been the practice of the state for quite some time, and it basically is the guidance provided by the National Disability Parking Law. So we're simply following national guidelines in regard to the two certificates. Many times people will own a primary vehicle but rely heavily on others to provide transportation, and it allows them to keep the certificate in their vehicle. And also, if someone were to give me a ride to, Target, we could still use disability parking. So it seems to be working, and it doesn't seem to have created a huge problem. Now, for your first question, I want to, is it okay if we flip to
Certainly.
Do you know Thomas? Okay.
My name is Tom Evans. I'm the supervisor for the special plate unit, and I also handle the disability certificates. We have contacted law enforcement about the number of violations given out for this. We have some rough, very rough estimates, but they've informed us that as a practice, they don't really keep these separate from other types of parking violations. All the parking violations are kind of grouped together. The best guess estimate we got was from Hennepin County and said they gave up like 10,000 in 1 year. But like I said, that's off the cuff.
If I might, for clarification, I guess what I'm trying to get at is there's been articles at various times, and I have two siblings that use the certificates, so I know how they work. That people would get their hands on a certificate that didn't belong to them and use them for free parking or whatever with the parking meters, et cetera. So if that's found to be true, don't you revoke the permit? Or doesn't somebody besides the police department know about this violation and keep track of the validity of the certificate and any consequences for the holder of the certificate if they're found allowing somebody to use it that's not supposed to? I mean, where's the oversight of that process?
Mr. Evans?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holbrook, our office, if we do get a report of misuse from law enforcement, we will cancel the certificate. Depending on the number of certificates that individual has already received, they can be recertified for another certificate. Right now, we don't essentially revoke a certificate. Revocation implies that there's also a means to have it reinstated. What we've chosen to follow is more of the cancellation policy, where if we get a certificate report misused, we cancel that certificate, and then that person has to in a sense recertify their disability, show that they're eligible for the certificate, and then what measures they use to make sure that it isn't misused in the future.
Mr. Chairman, I'll try a third time. So how many certificates do you cancel in an average year?
And I would say that it's less than 50.
Okay, thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, and are the federal guidelines, is this going to change the number of parking space ratio between handicapped and others, or is that strictly in zoning ordinances or local ordinance?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Cross.
Representative. It won't change the number of disability parking spaces required. That's covered by building code.
Are there any other questions or comments? If not, Representative Ruth is going to renew her motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I renew House File 1461 as amended, recommended to pass and sent to civil law.
All in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The bill passes and it's on its way to civil law. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair Member.
We now have the Department of Vehicle Services Agency bill presented by Representative Holberg, House File 1352.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Members. I'd like to move approval of House File 1352 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Election.
So moved. We're ready.
Mr. Chair, the bill before you, as in the last bill, I think we had the majority of the issues that probably fall under the purview of the Civil Law Committee, but I'll hit the highlights of those issues and spend a little more time on the ones that are probably before this committee. Sections 1 and 20 refer to bringing our laws about privacy of vehicle registration data in line with the federal standards. Basically, it changes us from an opt-out to an opt-in provision for certain uses. Some are expressly prohibited. And if you look on page 3 of Mr. Williams' summary, in which he always does a great job, but in particular, this has a copy of the U.S. code that governs the use of this type of data. And if you go to the second page of that, you can see on the back under items number 11 and 12, it talks about requests for this information in which the person has given express consent in the case of bulk distribution of surveys, marketing, solicitations, etc. So this Sections 1 and 20 conform to that federal standard. There's a subdivision that allows for a privacy classification for personal safety provides even more limits as to the distribution of that information. Section 2 of the bill provides for an alternative mailing address if for some reason the address on their driver's license and vehicle registration, they're not able to get mail at that address. Firms up that process a little bit. Sections 3 through 15 are more technical changes in the laws governing accident reporting. Section 16 through 19 have to do with court proceedings
more in the line of the Civil Law Committee. Section 20 we already covered. Section 21 puts the revisor to work, and Section 22 repeals the law that's on the books today that would basically be the opt-out provision for the privacy provisions. And I have representatives here from the Department of Public Safety, and Ms. Engler was in the audience earlier. She's not here for the data practices issues.
Can you tell me why we're doing this? We're doing a 180-degree turn on personal information here, I think.
Mr. Chair, I think that there's been greater awareness of government data, especially in the electronic age. In the old days, it used to be really a lot of work to get a bunch of names, addresses, and phone numbers to use for particular purposes. But now that all this data can all be put together and within a matter of minutes, millions of records of individuals can be put in a format that can be used for all kinds of things. I think there's a higher recognition. In addition, of course, you see increased concern about identity theft and et cetera. And so I think you're going to see more and more. We have put standards on the private sector versus opt-in and opt-out provisions, and quite frankly, I'm glad that the government is finally getting to a point where we're actually opt-in in order to share data. But you can see from the handout as well, they still protect a number of ways that data can be shared, having to do with accident reports or towing or different other agents of government needing the information for specific purposes. So it may not be as tight as some people would like, but it's a move in the right direction, in my opinion.
Well, maybe I misunderstand. When I read the summary, it looks like we're loosening up the ability of others to take personal information off your registration.
Mr. Chair and Committee, actually it's just the opposite. Currently right now, when you go to fill out a piece or fill out an application, there's a warning that your information be shared in a box that you can check if you do not want your information shared.
Right.
We're going to flip that around, and so that you actually have to make the action or the move in order to allow your information to be shared. So if you fail to act currently, they're selling your stuff.
Right.
In the future, if you fail to act, your information will be held private on you as an individual.
Okay. I'm not reading this correctly. Thank you.
Any questions or do you want to add anything?
What's the name?
I have a real concern as an attorney who sues people who don't pay, that this will make it more difficult to find debtors' assets in seeking to recover. And what I see the new standard as, the federal standard, 18 U.S.C. 2721, says that the department may disclose information when I'm doing an investigation in anticipation of litigation. And I want to know if the department knows how they're going to be using that discretion. I'd be much more comfortable if it said shall be disclosed, because generally people who don't pay their bills are very good at hiding where they keep their stuff.
And if I might still reference the page number and line that you're referring to in the bill.
I'm looking at the federal statute, which would be the new standard for disclosure of information in Minnesota. It's on page 3 of the memo put together by John Williams, and references the federal United States Code. So sub B, number 3B, and number 4. When you look at the last clause before the 1, 2, 3, 4, etc., it says that the information may be disclosed in these following circumstances. That means that there's no requirement that when I'm trying to find the deadbeat and where he keeps his cars, that the Department of Motor Vehicles has to give me the information.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Representative, the law, while the law is that we are putting into, we're codifying the law in terms of our current practice, we're already complying with these laws, and this is in fact, while it says we may, this is the department's practice currently. Rita Worm is with me, who's the manager of operations support and oversees data privacy for driver and vehicle services, and she can respond in more detail if need be.
You want more detail, Representative Whitman?
Mr. Chair, if I might, I think what we're trying to get at is what is your standard in the case of an attorney looking for assets related to a court case? What are your standards relative to this federal provision?
Currently? Well, Representative, I'm actually concerned about before the court case is filed, because it does me no good to sue somebody if I can't take their stuff after I win. So I want to find out if they have stuff and where it is before I even file the case.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as Pat was saying, this is codifying the current practice, and we've made it much easier to access our information for users that do have permissible uses within the federal law. We would enter into a data access agreement with any attorney, and they would have to sign an intended use statement, and we would actually give them a username and password and allow them to log right on to the system. This is not something that we would deny.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Ms. McClain.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the only thing I want to add is, as Rita said, we give a username and password because that allows the department to have auditing ability so that we can tell what records they're accessing. Every person has a unique password and username, so that if we need to see, if we get an allegation that someone is misusing our data, we have a way to audit their use and find out what records they have been using, and as part of their user agreement, they have to be able to share the reasons for that use if we investigate it or audit it further. So they're given notice. We will and can audit any information that they access. So we feel that gives us an additional oversight.
Yes, ma'am. I don't know what your name is, but...
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Representatives. Also, there's another half of the federal code. I believe it's sections 27, mm-hmm. 22 through 25, which is the disclosure statement of this section. And that is where they spell out all the civil and criminal remedies. So if somebody was accessing data and frauded an intended use statement, they would be held accountable. Thank you.
She didn't sign the statement, she said we get the correct spelling of your name. Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments? If not,
Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1352 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Elections.
All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and House File 1552 is on its way to civil law.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Okay, next up is a president. We might run over a few minutes here, but we're going to give Bob DeVore about a half hour, 30 minutes. Well, maybe a little less. Welcome to the committee, Bob, and you can introduce yourself if you would.
Good afternoon, Chairman Earhart, members of the committee. My name is Bob DeBoer. I'm Senior Program Associate for the Citizens League. And thanks very much for giving me a few minutes to talk about our Transportation Study Committee report entitled Driving Blind. I want to also say that our president, Sean Kershaw, really wanted to be here today, but we had our executive committee retreat all scheduled in advance, so he was not able to be here to present with me. But I just want to take a few minutes of your time to present, and then hopefully committee members who've had a chance maybe to look at a little of this will have some questions. I think it's really clear to everybody that there's some difficult decisions in what we're going to do about our transportation financing and decision making. And I think it's really necessary for the committee to know that the Citizens League approach here is we want to be helpful to trying to stimulate ideas. We in no way think that our work is some kind of last word on what needs to be done. but we absolutely think it's imperative that we start getting lots of ideas and possible solutions out on the table as we go forward in making some of these very large and long-term investments in transportation. To take you back just briefly to what this committee was charged with doing, we were charged with finding the true cost of our transportation options, which anybody who's looked at economic research realizes we probably had a took off a bigger bite than we could chew on, and we found after a few months of work that really that wasn't going to help us get closer to what policymakers and citizens needed to be able to start making better decisions. And it brought us really to the idea that within transportation we need to start thinking about a marketplace and what we want to have in our system. And that our main problem right now is that we don't have transparency in our funding system, and we do not have transparency in our decision making. And these two situations make it very difficult for people to look at all the options we have and try to make some forward-thinking decisions on what to do to help deal with the kind of growth we're having in the larger metropolitan region. So the question really is, why is the financing system broken? One of the studies we looked at, there's some very excellent work done in the Transportation and Regional Growth series at the University of Minnesota, and one of those pieces of work established that about 70% at that time, 1998, of our road dollars were really hidden costs or costs that weren't priced to the users of the road. And this means things like our use of property taxes, sales taxes, even our vehicle registration fees, the way that they're set up, have nothing to do with behavior or impact on the use of the roads. And this doesn't get us anywhere closer to figuring out what people would choose to do if they really were experiencing the kind of costs of our road system keeping up with what we want to do and how we're growing. The other half of the equation is about the decision making. We feel that decision making is really impaired at this point. The gas tax, which essentially is the user fee that we have, is not transparent in how it's spent because of the constitutional dedication and the formulas established in there that have now been around for about 50 years, make it very unclear to anybody who's looking at that pot of money going, gee, how are we deciding what we build and when and what we maintain and when? And part of that is, NMDOT, of course, has their way of doing things, which is hard for many people to see through. But then there's also another part of the process which has to do with our local government municipal consent and our veto authorities that really make it difficult for policymakers, I think, to understand exactly what's going on when these decisions are made, and certainly very difficult for citizens. We have seven recommendations in our report, but I just want to highlight three of them. And really, this is a very long-term approach we've taken in this report, and the three that I'm going to highlight are the ones that we think action can be taken on right away. We've engaged the legislative auditor and the chair and the co-chair of that commission, asking them if they think they have some good ideas of how to bring some clarity into the idea of what we subsidize and how much between transit and between driving, because we think in our deliberations we heard a lot of different numbers, a lot of different thoughts, and it seemed to us that if policymakers are going to be fighting over that part, we won't get very far. So we've started that, but we've also asked them on this process question that I just explained, if there's some light they can shed on that, how the process actually works today between MnDOT and the local governments and developers when we make some of these decisions on where we're going to spend our money. The second recommendation I'd like to highlight goes back to the idea that we really don't have flexibility in our funding. And where that comes out, this is recommendation number 5 in the report, is in making any kind of strategic investments in things like employers providing more commuting options, telecommuting, different types of circulator functions that maybe we haven't tried before in some of these areas where we know traditional transit is really not going to do the trick. This session, we are in discussions now about possible tax incentives that we think we may introduce in a week or two that may address some of these issues, but we're doing some research to see if there are incentives that would really have an impact in the marketplace. And then the third one I'd like to highlight from our recommendations is in the use of tax increment financing, particularly on undeveloped lands. We really think that the effect on the arterial road system needs to be part of that calculation when there's a decision for a large development somewhere and they're going to capture the increment to pay for it and it's going to create demand on the transportation system. We think that measurable increment needs to help pay for the arterial road system in those cases. So those are the three we're really trying to work on this session. And really, there's a lot of other things in this report, and hopefully some of you have had a few moments to look at it. And we'd welcome any questions and remind all the members that we really want to push some ideas and stimulate some discussion. Thank you very much.
Are there any? Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. DeBoer, I caught this earlier and I started perusing it. It's a very interesting document and have a lot yet to look at here. I'm encouraged by the effort to look at this. Nonetheless, I have some concerns. And I'd like to just identify something and then ask if you considered this in your report. In your analysis, I believe that, if I'm not mistaken, our highway system and its funding mechanisms is really probably the best system we have. And while it's valuable to study this and improve upon the good things we have, I mean, I think there's a lot more things that also need this kind of work. But we do need to improve upon this because it affects everybody. This is one of the systems that really does affect every single person in the state in a big way. But you noted the only user-funded mechanism we have is the gas tax. And I want to recognize something that I didn't realize for a long, long time. And that is user funding for a highway system by the nature of the system and how it operates and what it takes to establish a load, I think requires more than a usage tax or a mechanism that is paid when you use it. Because what it takes to establish a road is a lot, sometimes years. And the moment I buy a car, I think it justifies paying a tax, even if I don't intend to use that car for 2 years. Because the state has no way of knowing if I'm going to use it for 2 years or if I'm going to use it the next day. And the fact that I buy that car creates a potential use that they have no control over, the state has no control over, and therefore I think what we have is a much better system than we've realized and a much better system that I see recognized with all due respect in your report, because the motor vehicle sales tax, the motor vehicle gas, the registration tax, both are taxed based on potential use. In fact, I think I've come to the place where I'm starting to think that we need to forget about raising the gas tax. We need to look at these other taxes because of the potential use out there in the fact that we need more roads, reflecting that we're not meeting the needs of the potential use, that's the area where I think we actually need to look at tax increases to pay for these roads, because that's how we're getting hit. The gas tax really should be something that pays for maintenance more so, and the other taxes should be maybe looking at, we should be looking at using them more to pay for the infrastructure and that potential use that we live with every day. I mean, something could happen and all of a sudden use just jumps up and we have no way to control that. So you need a balance of those two taxes. That being said, I also want to emphasize in the property tax, it's amazing to consider, yes, it's hidden a little bit, but with the state average tax outstate being just over $1,000, state average property tax for each household in the metro area being just over $2,000, if you consider what people get, albeit it is hidden a bit, it's still very, very effective. We might find that if we expose this, people will be willing to pay more property taxes, because look at all the services they're getting. They're getting everything from police, fire, ambulance, you know, hospital in many cases, and schools and county services and all the social services and on down the list, the welfare benefits in many cases. And for that amount of money, plus roads. So we really have a remarkably well-established system in its funding mechanism. It's the only system we have that I know of that is the closest to 100% user-funded. In fact, just isolating the state roads, and I'll be very concerned if you don't have this in this report, just looking at state roads, breaking off local roads, we're putting money in the general fund. We're not using all that money. So as we struggle with our funding mechanisms, I have to say, if we agree that the motor vehicle sales tax should go to roads, then we're putting money into the general fund. I need to back up on that. And I believe we should. So we have a remarkably good system, and I commend you for studying that, but I hope those things were considered. Can you identify that?
Mr. DeLores?
Yes, Chairman Earhart, Representative Olson. I think a few of those things we certainly did identify. In terms of transportation use, particularly road use, we feel that unlike some other policy areas like K-12 education or health care perhaps, that it is the user is more able to pay and it's more appropriate for them to pay for their use. And I think the vehicle registration fee, for example, we do think should be based more on road impact and that more money should be raised that way. And so that really does talk to the upfront when you get a vehicle that the state is able to really capture some more funding towards the ultimate use. I think part of the reason that we really have trouble with the current system is we do feel the constitutional amendment has got us in a box in terms of flexibility. We would like to see the money dedicated to all transportation facilities and services so that we can look at all our strategic options. But we don't deny that the gas tax is a very good user fee. We wouldn't call the motor vehicle sales tax. Really, it's unclear to me why that isn't considered a general fund revenue. Anything else it is. It goes to the general fund. But there's been this desire to capture it for transportation over the years, and I don't think there's any other policy area where we would try to do that. If I were a college student buying textbooks, I pay a sales tax on my textbook, but we don't say that should go to higher education, for example. And it's been something I think that we've tried to do as people have felt we haven't had enough money to perhaps pay for the roads the way we want to. But we would also say we're not sure really how much money is needed. I think there's some good estimates out there based on how we raise money and spend it today, but we're saying we're not sure that's the most efficient way to do it. Because of the constitutional dedication.
Representative Olson. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. DeBoer. There's a good policy argument for the motor vehicle sales tax not necessarily being a 100% user tax until you get to the fact that that the second time you, when you resell a car, it's taxed again and again and again. And I don't know of any other product that, that it works like that. And in that respect, it kind of brings it into this category, I believe, of being kind of a user-funded system. And if that's where the debate comes down, I mean, I think one could argue that that the second-time revenues on the resale of vehicles should all go to roads, and the first time go in the general fund and use it for the transit. Where I have a concern with taking a really good system compared to our other funding systems, mechanisms, and identifying these concerns and saying we need more flexibility, is that we may need more flexibility so we can fund transit better and cut the roads short more. When in fact that's the problem we have right now, and why we're short roads, is putting too much emphasis into transit with road money. And that's very troubling to me, because this has got to be one of the most successful systems in the history of the state, if not this country. For the for the amount of revenue it produces and enables us to meet people's needs and the kind of prosperity it has brought to our nation. And it really concerns me that if we go down the path of creating more flexibility, because the only time it's really, I think, beneficial to the citizens of the state to have a 100% user, to have a user-funded system is when it is in fact a 100% user-funded system. So we in this place can't play any games. And every time I go buy a car, I know how much my roads cost. Every time I pay registration taxes, I know how much my roads cost. And every time I fill up, I know how much my roads cost. And I know all that money goes there. And if we're short roads, I will say as a citizen of this state, along with many others, we need to raise my taxes. That's the beauty of that user-funded system that we almost have. And that concerns me that we would back away from that so we could be more flexible in this place and turn around and fund something that isn't paying its way, and people don't know that. Clarity is important. Information is important. I totally agree with you. But if that flexibility means we're going to cloud these issues between what's paying its way and what isn't, I beg your pardon, but I don't agree.
Does anyone else have any questions or comments?
I do.
Representative Hartman.
I don't want to lengthen the amount of time that we have this conversation, so but I have to respond to...
You don't have to say anything.
I know. I really do. We aren't almost user-funded. When you look at the amount of property taxes that pave roads, it doesn't do me any good to have Highway 252 mostly paid for by the gas tax if I can't get from my house, my front door, to Highway 252. And the average person has no concept of how much of their property tax is going to pay for roads. So people aren't making a rational decision right now on what our policy priorities should be. And, you know, I think we have some good things in our transportation system, but I don't think that it's that close to 100% user fee system, and I don't think it's the greatest funding mechanism that's been set up in the United States. I mean, I think the way that we fund transportation right now distorts people's choices away from transit because roads are subsidized in a way that we don't talk about, we don't recognize. There's a tremendous amount of property tax dollars subsidizing our roads.
What are your thoughts?
Not to belabor the point, Mr. Chair, but I think that it's very important to realize that if we're going to have property taxes support things like that, people need to recognize the things that they may not feel that are tied directly to transportation, and things like the goods and commerce that are delivered on those roads to them, the food they get, the emergency vehicles and so forth. We can't have a system that simply says, well, because I don't drive, I choose to take mass transit, let's say, that your property taxes should go down and remove the cost of transportation from it, because we're all in this together, and if we all start segmenting down into little groups, we're going to start eating each other. And I think that it is a much wider picture. I hear what Representative Olson is saying on the cost, and I hear what Representative Hartman is saying too. And I just think it's whatever people have to do to get to where they're okay in their head, let them do it. But
Yeah, and if I could just make a comment.
Right. Maybe you can wind it up with a comment.
Sure. I think it's really important, at least in my mind, that our committee had no assumption about how transit and roads would stack up against each other. I think in Minnesota right now, we are still tending towards more road use, and that's what people want, and that's what people generally want to pay for. And we're not saying that if we put all this together, we're going to see all of a sudden a bunch of transit projects jump ahead of it. We don't assume that. But we do think if people experience the cost more directly of what they're doing, they might say, no, I don't want to buy another car if I have some other options, or I don't want to buy a third car if I have some other options. But I don't think we really have a sense of what that marketplace is right now. And that's what we're trying to lay a little groundwork for in this report. We're not assuming an end result of the work at all. We're trying to open the door a little bit, we think.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. And with that, I think we'll be in adjournment.